All right, welcome to the deep dive, everybody. Today we're going deep on a case that's well, it's kind of a must-know if you're really serious about securities law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And especially about how shareholders can actually, flex their muscles a bit, especially when it comes to those, proxy statements.
Yeah, you got it.
We're talking about J.I. Case Co. v. Borac, back from 1964. So for all of you out there who are, trying to wrap your heads around corporate governance and all that, think of this as like your cheat sheet to understanding how shareholder remedies, took a big step forward.
Oh, yeah.
But, with some maybe some unexpected turns on the road.
Definitely some twists and turns in this one. If you really want to get the lay of the land in corporate law, especially when it comes to federal securities regulations, Borac is it's essential. Like, how much power do corporations have versus their shareholders? You know, that kind of thing. That's what Borac is all about. So what we're going to do today is really break down the core of the Supreme Court's decision in Borac. You know, like, what were they thinking? Why did they decide what they decided? And how does this case still matter today? You know, like in securities litigation, in the role of federal courts.
You know, instead of just like throwing a dense legal text at you and being like, good luck. We're gonna unpack it
We'll
together.
make sense of it.
So to get started, let's look at the situation that led to this whole lawsuit, right? We've got this proposed merger between J.I. Case Co. and American Tractor Corp., ATC for short. Now, to get a merger like this done, you need the shareholders to say yes.
Got to have that approval.
And that's where, the proxy statements come into play. So, like, imagine you're Carl Borac. He's a shareholder in Case, owns like 2,000 shares. Not a small fry,
Yeah, not at all.
He looks at these documents that are supposed to convince everyone to vote yes on this merger, and he's like, hold on a sec.
Yeah, he smelled something fishy.
Something's not right here. So what exactly was Borac's beef with these materials?
Well, Borac claimed that the proxy statements, the ones the company's directors were sending out to get that shareholder approval for the merger, had some, well, let's just say some creative accounting. He thought they were straight up false and misleading, intended to paint a rosier picture of the merger than reality. And he pointed to Section 14A of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and specifically Rule 14A9, which basically says you can't lie to shareholders when you're trying to get their votes.
It all has to be above them.
Full transparency, that's the idea.
So Borac was basically saying, look, because these proxy statements were bogus, the vote that approved this merger shouldn't count.
That's the gist of it, yeah.
He felt like shareholders had been tricked and the merger shouldn't be allowed to go through. And, you can see his point, right? If you're making a decision about something as big as a merger, you need accurate information.
Absolutely. Shareholders need to be able to trust that the information they're getting is reliable.
So where did he take this? Like, what was the first step in his legal battle?
Well, he went to the district court, right? That's usually the first stop. But he hit a wall there. The court basically said, okay, yeah, maybe the proxy statements were misleading, but all we can give you is a declaratory judgment.
So they basically just said, yep, those were bad, and then did nothing.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like saying, you're right, but we're not going to do anything about it.
What good is that?
Well, a declaratory judgment basically just states what the law is or how it applies in a specific situation.
But it doesn't actually fix the problem.
So it's kind of like the court acknowledges there's a problem, but it doesn't actually provide a solution.
It's like a judge saying foul, but then letting the game continue with the bad score.
Good analogy. But luckily for Borac, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals saw things a little differently.
Okay, they must have had a different take.
Yeah, they did. They overturned the district court's decision, which basically opened the door for Borac to get some real relief.
So not just this, like, slap on the wrist, yeah, you were wrong kind of thing.
No, something with teeth. And this was the step that got the Supreme Court involved.
Right, because now it's like a big deal.
Yeah, big precedent could be set.
So what was the big legal question that the Supreme Court had to grapple with?
All right, so here's the million-dollar question. Does Section 27 of the Securities Exchange Act, the part that gives federal courts the power to hear these kinds of cases, cases about the act being broken, does that also kind of implicitly give them the power to grant some real meaningful relief.
Meaningful relief? Like what?
Like undoing the merger or, yeah, you know, giving money, damages to the shareholders who were harmed by these shady proxy statements.
So did they? Did the Supreme Court say federal courts have that power?
They did. It was a big resounding yes.
Wow.
And this is a ruling that has echoed through legal history ever since. They said, yes, federal courts, you absolutely have broad authority to enforce those shareholder protections in Section 14A.
So big win for Borac and for shareholders in general.
Absolutely. A landmark decision for shareholder rights. And the reasoning they used is fascinating. They leaned on this concept called an implied private right of action.
Implied private right of action. Okay, break that down for us.
Okay, so it's a legal term,
right?
Right. And it basically means that even if a law doesn't explicitly say you can sue for something,
right,
the courts can say you can sue if they believe that's what Congress really intended.
So it's like reading between the lines of the law.
Exactly, exactly. And that's what the Supreme Court did here.
So in this specific case with Section 14A, it doesn't actually say, hey, shareholders, if you get tricked by a proxy statement, you can sue for damages.
Nope, not in those exact words.
But the court was like, come on, it's pretty obvious that Congress wanted to protect shareholders.
Right. The whole point of the law was to make sure investors were being treated fairly and to ensure those corporate elections were on the up and up.
Right. If you couldn't sue when you were misled, what's the point of the law?
Right. It would be totally toothless. And Justice Clark, in the majority opinion, really nailed it. He said, and I'm quoting here, the purpose of Section 14A is to prevent management or others from obtaining authorization for corporate action by means of deceptive or inadequate disclosure in proxy solicitation.
So basically, don't lie to shareholders to get what you want.
Exactly.
And they didn't stop there. They actually went on to say that letting shareholders sue, this whole private enforcement thing, is a necessary supplement to what the SEC does.
Right. Because let's be real, the SEC is powerful, but they can't be everywhere at once.
Right. They can't catch every little sneaky thing companies might try to pull.
They don't have the resources to go over every single proxy statement with a fine-tooth comb.
So by letting individual shareholders bring their own lawsuits, it creates like this extra layer of protection.
Right? Exactly. It's like a check and balance. The shareholders become these like watchdogs.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
Making sure companies are playing by the rules.
Okay. So that's the implied private right of action. But there's this whole other issue that comes into play here, right? Federalism.
Ah, yes. The age old question of who has the power, the states or the feds.
So like, why did the Supreme Court say that federal remedies should trump state laws in this area, especially since, you know, corporate law has traditionally been like a state thing?
Right. Historically, states have had a lot of say in how corporations are run within their borders.
So why the federal power grab, essentially?
Well, not quite a power grab, but you see the tension, right? The Supreme Court basically said, look, we can't let state laws get in the way of what the Securities Exchange Act is trying to do. You know, imagine a scenario where, say, Wisconsin, where J.I. case was based, had a law that made it really hard to undo a merger, even if there was proxy fraud.
Right.
The Supreme Court was like, nope, federal law trumps that. Shareholders have rights under federal law, and those rights need to be protected.
So even if Wisconsin law said, tough luck, no rescission for you, the federal courts could still step in.
Exactly.
And that's because of the supremacy clause in the Constitution.
Right. That's the big hammer. Federal law is the supreme law of the land.
So when there's a conflict between a state law and a federal law,
the federal law wins.
Federal law wins every time.
It's like rock, paper, scissors.
Okay, so the court basically drew a line in the sand, right? They said, when it comes to protecting shareholders from these misleading proxy statements, federal courts have the final say.
Exactly. And that was a huge shift because before this, state laws pretty much dominated corporate stuff.
So that part's pretty clear. Federal courts have the power to provide these remedies,
yep,
even if it steps on the toes of state corporate law a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. But the case didn't end there.
Oh, it didn't. I thought that was the whole thing.
Oh, no, there's more. See, the Supreme Court didn't just say, hey, remedies are available, case closed. They actually sent the case back to the lower courts.
Why? What else was there to decide?
Oh, there was this big unanswered question. Did those misleading proxy statements actually cause the shareholders to vote for the merger?
Oh, I see. So it's not enough to just show that the statements were misleading. You have to prove that they actually made a difference.
Precisely. There has to be that direct link, what we lawyers call causation.
Causation. Okay. So, like, They needed to show that enough shareholders were swayed by the bad information.
Yeah, that it actually flipped the vote.
Otherwise, even if the proxy statement was full of lies, if the merger was going to pass anyway.
Right, like if it had overwhelming support regardless.
Then maybe there isn't really any harm done.
Exactly. No harm, no foul, as they say, though it's a bit more complicated than that legally.
Right, right. Okay, so Borac was this huge decision, right? It established this implied right of action for shareholders, gave federal courts more power in this area of securities law.
Big time.
But what happened after? Did things just stay the same? Or did this case have a ripple effect?
Oh, it definitely had a ripple effect. Initially, Borac was like this big legal earthquake. It set this major precedent, not just for securities law, but for the idea that courts could look at a law's purpose and say, you know what, even if it doesn't explicitly say you can sue, we think Congress intended for you to be able to sue.
So it opened the floodgates, kind of?
In a way, yeah. You saw a lot more shareholder lawsuits popping up, challenging all sorts of corporate shenanigans, not just proxy stuff.
Right, because now shareholders had this powerful tool in their arsenal.
Exactly. But as with most things in the law, the pendulum swings back and forth.
It always does, doesn't it?
It does. And in the years since Borac, we've seen the Supreme Court become a bit more hesitant about this whole implied right of action thing.
Yeah, they've pumped the brakes a bit, haven't they?
Yeah. They have. Cases like Stone Ridge and Sandoval, those come to mind?
Stone Ridge, Sandoval, okay. So what happened in those cases?
Well, they represent a shift towards a more textualist approach to interpreting laws.
Textualist, meaning they're really focused on the actual words of the law.
Exactly. Back when Borac was decided, courts were a bit more willing to look at the big picture, the overall intent of a law, and say, okay, if this is what Congress wanted to achieve, then this right to sue must exist, even if they didn't say it outright.
Mm.
But in these later cases, the Supreme Court said, hold on, we need to stick to the actual text of the law. If Congress didn't specifically say you can sue for this, then you can't.
So they're basically saying, if it's not written in the law, it doesn't exist.
Pretty much. They're like, show me the words, show me where Congress said you could sue.
So does that mean that Borac is no longer good law?
Well, not exactly. Borac hasn't been overturned, and it's still the law when it comes to those specific shareholder protections in Section 14A. But the way courts think about implied rights of action has definitely changed since Borac.
Right, so that broader principle from Borac, that courts can just imply a right to sue whenever they think Congress wanted it.
Yeah, that's taken a hit.
It's not as strong as it used to be.
Exactly. You could say that that aspect of Borac, the whole implied right reasoning, is on life support.
Wow, life support. That's a pretty strong statement.
It is. Back then, courts were asking, what's the purpose of this law? But these days, the question is, did Congress actually say, in black and white, that you can sue?
That's a big difference, yeah.
Huge difference. But even with this narrowing trend, Borac is still a landmark case. It really cemented the role of federal courts in enforcing securities laws.
Right.
And it made it crystal clear that shareholders have these important protections, especially when it comes to things like proxy statements.
So it laid the groundwork for a lot of the shareholder litigation that we see even today.
Absolutely. It was a turning point. Even if the legal tools and the court's willingness to use them have evolved, Borac remains a foundational case.
All right, so let's sum it all up.
Mm-hmm.
Our deep dive into J.I. Case Co. v. Borac shows us this really important moment in securities law.
Yeah.
Where the Supreme Court said, hey, shareholders have the right to sue in federal court if they're misled by proxy statements.
Right, a key. Right.
And that decision has had a lasting impact, both on how corporations are governed and on how securities laws are enforced.
Absolutely. It shaped the playing field.
But of course, the legal world is always changing, right?
Always evolving. Yep.
And the way courts view these implied rights of action, it's become more strict over time.
Definitely more strict.
So that leaves us with a question for you all to ponder, you know, as you continue your legal journeys.
Something to chew on.
Given how skeptical courts are today about these implied rights, if the exact same situation from Borac happened today.
Right. Same facts, same everything.
Would the Supreme Court still reach the same conclusion?
That's the question. It really makes you think about how legal reasoning changes over time.
Right. Right. And how this focus on the exact text of a law, this textualism,
yeah,
how that affects what remedies shareholders can actually get.
The whole new ballgame in some ways.
It is. It is. And if you want to go deeper on this, I'd recommend looking at some of those later Supreme Court cases we mentioned.
Yeah, good idea. See how they've narrowed things down.
Stone Ridge, Sandoval, those are good starting points.
Those are the ones.
All right. Well, that was our deep dive into J.I. Case Co. v. Borak.
It was a deep one.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thanks for listening.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.